And welcome, everyone. This is the 2016-17 Transmission Planning Process Stakeholder Meeting. We're here to discuss the preliminary policy and economic study results. I'm Kim Perez. I'm with the ISO Stakeholder Process Group. Material related to our stakeholder meeting today can be found on our website under the Stay Informed tab, then select the Stakeholder Processes section, and then click on the transmission planning, and then you'll find all the material related to today's discussion. Our agenda for today begins with a brief overview from Neil Miller. Then we're going to spend a good part of our morning discussing the team methodology. And just as an FYI, that portion of today's meeting will be recorded, and we will be posting it online. From there, we're going to move into the preliminary policy results, and then we'll break for lunch. We'll return from lunch probably about 12:45, then we'll discuss the preliminary economic results. From there, we'll hear from our regional transmission engineers with their updates on the special studies. Our final presentation today will come from Jeff Billington with his presentation on the review of the projects in the North area. And then finally, I'll provide the brief wrap-up for you. So during our meeting today, if you have a question or comment, you can enter the queue by selecting #2 if you're on the phone. Please remember to state your name and the company that you represent before asking your question. Just a couple little housekeeping. If you are connecting via the web, you do not, or for Wi-Fi, you don't need a password. It's just ISO_guest. Select the terms and conditions, and you should be all set. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Neil Miller, and we'll get started.
Thank you very much, Kim, and thank you, everyone, for taking the time to participate in this, the third stakeholder session associated with the 16-17 transmission planning process. As in the past, I'm going to touch on a number of overarching issues just to set the stage for some of the later presentations, and we'll just dive right in. So, a graph for a version that many of you have seen this before, the You Are Here slide. So we're at our third stakeholder session. This is in November, as we drive towards completing a draft transmission plan by the end of January for presentation to our Board of Governors at the March Board of Governors meeting. Today's session does focus on the review of the preliminary reliability analysis and economic analysis that we've performed. We've also added in a note that another focus here is an update on some of the ongoing reliability analysis issues and special studies, which are, as we've been moving forward, have been generating more and more interest. As in the past, consistent with our transmission planning cycle, the comprehensive plan is built up in the same sequence of events, looking at reliability analysis first, then layering on any additional policy requirements, then looking to see if there are any further enhancements that would be warranted based on the economic benefits they provide to ratepayers in the ISO footprint. We also, of course, conduct a number of special studies looking at additional issues, trying to get ahead of the curve on understanding certain issues that aren't necessarily part of the approved plan per se, and they're not a tariff requirement to complete. But we do see these studies as becoming more and more important as we deal with emerging issues. Just to recap the milestones, the preliminary results were shared on August 15th for reliability analysis. We had a two-day stakeholder session on September 21st and 22nd. We received comments on October 6th. We did have an extension of the comments for slow response resource special studies to October 10th to accommodate a separate stakeholder consultation that went on. The request window closed October 15th. That brings us to today's session, sharing our preliminary policy and economic results. We will be looking for comments by November 30th and posting the draft plan by January 2017. There will be a fourth stakeholder event in February to review the draft plan before we finalize and make any revisions necessary to bring the plan to our board for approval in March. I wanted to touch on a few key aspects of what's going into this session and the results. The policy-driven renewable generation portfolios that we've used for our policy-driven transmission analysis were received again from CPUC and the California Energy Commission Those arrived on June 13, 2016. A couple of key points is that the decision was to go with the same portfolios as the previous year, recognizing that we are driving towards the 33% RPS goal by 2020, but we're not yet positioned to move forward on 50% or portfolios that go beyond the 33%. Another key quote I'll refer you to was that the expectation is that at this point, it's really undesirable to be trying to trigger additional major transmission to achieve renewable portfolio standard goals until we get the clarity on where the 50% portfolios would be landing. So we did also receive what I'll call non-binding portfolios from the CPUC that were informational that we could use for our 50% RPS special studies. But those, like I said, are strictly for information purposes only. Oh, I should have also mentioned that because we were using the same portfolios as last year, the only area where there was any material change in circumstance because of our neighbors' plans is in the Imperial Valley area. So that was the area that was focused on for the policy-driven review this year. And there's a presentation later today or later this morning to talk about the results of that study. One issue that we address each year in the November stakeholder session is this is our opportunity to present to industry any projects that are less than $50 million that we intend to move forward through the management approval route as opposed to having our board approve those projects in March. That helps streamline the overall plan approval process each year. The expectation is that we would present those projects to industry and we try to take advantage of this stakeholder session. We then ensure that there is a board meeting between us presenting the results and management actually approving any of those projects so that if someone takes exception to any of the things we're looking at moving forward with, they do have an opportunity to raise their concerns with our Board of Governors. Now, in this year's cycle, this is a non-event because we have not identified any less than $50 million projects that we intend to move forward through the management approval route. There are some smaller, less than $50 million projects that we're looking at in the transmission plan. These do tend to be tied up with some other issues, so we think it's more appropriate that they move forward through the completed transmission plan rather than on a separate management approval track. The other area that's been occupying a lot of the planner's time this year is the special study work that's in progress. There are six special studies being conducted in as part of the overall transmission planning cycle. I'm just going to touch very briefly on the ones that aren't the subject of a later presentation today. First is the continuation of the frequency response efforts where we are focusing on improving our modeling of the dynamic performance of the generators in the ISO footprint. The review has been going fairly well. We've identified a fairly large number of generators that we do believe some modifications need to be made to their modeling for a whole range of reasons. And we do expect, we've been working with the participating transmission owners, we do expect communication out to all of those generators, the owners of those generators, by mid-December. And the goal is to get updated models turned around in the early part of next year. On our large-scale storage benefits study, we did receive comments through the last stakeholder process. That work is in progress. We don't have any preliminary results we can share yet because a lot of the work is building the models. Running the models actually comes later, so we will be keeping you informed as we go through the next planning updates. The slow response work on the study of slow response resources to be relied on in local capacity areas. Since our September 21st session, there was also a separate workshop that the ISO led with the CPUC, a joint workshop focusing on this specific issue. It went beyond the technical studies that we presented at the September 21st stakeholder session and also got into the mechanics of how would these resources actually be getting dispatched. We have received comments back on both aspects. We do see the need to go back working with the transmission owners and update the make some updates to our studies to reflect the comments that we've received. So that work will be going on a bit of a parallel track, and there is another joint stakeholder session workshop being planned in the mid-December time frame, looking at those issues. We will be wanting to also make sure that the technical work that we do is also reported back through our transmission planning process so that stakeholders that are following this process are kept informed of that technical work. So even though the work itself will now be moving off onto a bit of a parallel track, our commitment is to keep the information alive in both processes. Now, the risk of early economic retirement of the gas fleet, that's another situation where there's been a lot of work done in building our analysis, but we're not ready yet to share preliminary results. So we'll be looking at doing that at our next stakeholder event. We do have presentations in today's material to update, provide updates on the gas electric reliability coordination issue, as well as the 50% renewable generation scenarios that are also tied to the interregional coordination efforts. And as mentioned earlier, Jeff will be touching on the review of previously approved projects in the PG&E service area. The only other comment I'd make before we move on is that, as I indicated in previous meetings, the special study list that we took on and the issues we're dealing with there, it's a very aggressive study program. As we started getting into the detail and modified our study scopes based on comments we received, we acknowledged that we will be looking to share draft results on all of this work at the February stakeholder session. We're not sure it's viable at this time to guarantee that the work will be documented in the draft plan at the end of January, but it would be included in the draft that goes to our board for approval in the March timeframe. So the goal here is to get the information to you as quickly as possible, but we also have to be practical about the challenges of the volume of additional special studies we undertook this year, and we didn't want to trim some out for the sake of carrying some others forward on our original timeline. Now, the next topic, I just wanted to say one more word about the next presentation focusing on the team methodology. We did devote more time this year and set out time specifically to go through the methodology itself for two reasons. One, we are looking at updating our documentation of not changing the methodology, but updating our documentation of the methodology. So we felt it was a good exercise to go through to walk through what is the current team methodology, also recognizing that for people who are reading the existing documentation, it's quite stale, so we thought this would be helpful. As well, this gave us an opportunity to provide an overview of the existing ISO team methodology for people who might be dialing in from out of state or otherwise participating in some of the regionalism discussions where options are being considered around potential regional approaches to high voltage transmission access charges and so forth. And the team methodology has been a topic in those discussions where people have expressed an interest in better understanding what the team methodology is and how it works. So this session is more, I'll say, informational and educational, and then we'll be moving into the content and some of the discussions later. So I hope that provides some context for today's session. Looking forward to getting into the content, but I'll stop there now and see if there are any questions with the material I covered.
Hi, Kevin Woodruff, consultant for TURN. And on this slide, you talk about detailed results we provided in the final draft plan. It sounds like there's not going to be any sort of stakeholder process between the production of those results and the board meeting, or?
We'll be presenting, some results we're sharing as we go through.
Right, I understand.
So we'll be looking for comments on some special studies coming out of today's session. Others, such as the slow response resources, there will be a separate track,
right?
So there are opportunities there. We will be sharing our draft results at the February stakeholder session, and then
okay.
There is a comment period after that. I admit it's quite tight. But that's why we're trying to keep people as informed as possible as we go through the cycle.
Okay, so the results, that the detailed results that are in the draft final plan will get some sort of vetting as draft results in the February stakeholder meeting, is that?
Yes.
For some of these, the ones that you're
presenting. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Neil, before you leave and we bring up our team methodology presentation, we do have one question on the phone. Erin, if we can go to Susan Schneider.
Hi, this is Susan Schneider, Phoenix Consulting. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I actually have a little bit of a follow-up question on Tern's comment, and I had a couple of other questions that are process-related. So you're going to have your preliminary results in February, but you're not going to have the detailed results for the special studies. For all the special studies, may not come out until the draft. When you say the draft final proposal, that's the one that goes to the board in March, right?
Yes. That's right. It would be the one that goes to the board in March.
Okay, so the draft plan comes out in January. That wouldn't have that information. We'll see the preliminary results in February. And you can comment on the preliminary results, but I think what Tern's question was going toward, if I could put words into their mouth, is that the detailed results and the details of that will be coming into the draft final that goes to the board will not have, there's no stakeholder ability to comment on that version. Is that right?
If the one that goes to the board, no other than the board meeting itself.
Okay, right. That was the concern that Tern had, and I think other people may have that concern as well. Okay, that was just a clarification.
Yes.
I had a couple of other questions process-wise.
I should just clarify, what we're saying now is it may not be in the draft plan. We will be trying to include as much as we have available.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks. Okay, two other questions I had on just process-wise. The ready analysis is being done now in addition to 50% RPS. Can you just talk for a second about... Yeah, I think the CPC usually gives you portfolios like around March or April or so for the following cycle. And are you, if for the material that comes out of READY, are you waiting for it to go through the CPC, be translated into the 50% RPS portfolios, and is that when you expect to address those in the regular studies, the main studies?
I'm looking around the room to see if anyone from the CPC might want to address that, but at this point our understanding is that with the development of the IRP process at the CPC, that it's extremely unlikely we get portfolios for 50% analysis in the 17-18 cycle. The RETI work is informing the CPUC. It's one of many inputs, but we see that work being taken into account as one of many inputs in the CPUC process that will ultimately produce the 50% portfolios. And we're not expecting to see anything by the for the 2017-18 planning cycle.
Okay, so as far as you know, you're still planning on doing 33% RPS.
Well, we really haven't firmed up. Let me back up on this. We'll be posting a draft study plan early next year, looking at the 17-18 cycle, getting comments. So we really haven't started talking about what that cycle will look like. But expecting portfolios for 50% from the CPC, that I don't think is practical.
Okay.
And I think Keith White from the CPC would like to comment.
It's Keith White, CPU staff, and I do not work on the IRP, so that's where I'm coming from. But it's a very unprecedented and huge effort, and I see the people working on it. And I think at this point, it's not a good idea to anticipate things coming out and the schedule that was just suggested. But I would suggest, and I think some of the people here are already doing this, get involved in the IRP process itself if you want to understand where it's going and comment on it. I think that's the best thing to do rather than sort of speculate here what might happen.
Thank you very much, okay. Keith.
And then I just had one more question on process. The storage study, Is that going to be done on a 50% RPS or a 33% or some other thing?
The plan right now is 50% RPS portfolios using those same informational portfolios.
Okay, and can you, thank you, and can you comment on what other projects besides the Eagle Mountain might be in that analysis?
I thought we had a list. I should go back to check, but I believe there are three projects we were looking at. I'll look down the row at Robert Sparks, as I say, Lake Elsinore Advanced Storage Project, Eagle Crest, and San Vicente Storage in the San Diego area.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Those are all my questions.
Okay. I should apologize. It looks like we're getting quite a few questions. We have a lot of people on that are participating specifically for the team methodology. What I would like to suggest is that we move to the team methodology, and then I'll offer to get back up before we go into the results so that any other follow-up questions, we can make sure everybody gets a chance. That doesn't seem to quite work for everyone.
Actually, my question has to do with the team methodology. And this is Tom Miller here, Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And our team would like to get some, this is sort of an ask as we go through the presentation. I really appreciate that. We looked at the slides, and I think there will be a lot of good insights. But we would, if possible, to the extent practical, we'd like to get some more understanding of what's under the hood. So what are your primary references for the assumptions? What production cost modeling are you used to, is a good view, you know, to supply that? More definition on the components of cost and benefits. So that's just in general, that's an ask.
Okay.
So thank you. I didn't see that in the slide, so that's before going into it, to the extent you can give us some insight, that would be very helpful.
That's great, and to the extent if there are questions we're not able to provide answers to today, then I'd encourage you to comment section. We do provide written responses to all the comments we receive, so that's another opportunity if we're not able to catch it today. Thank you. Okay, so like I said, I will have an opening for more questions later if there are, but I think we should move into the team methodology to set the people free who are focused on that issue. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Neil. Next up then is Yi Zheng for his presentation on the team methodology.
Good morning. My name is Yi Zhang. My presentation is a team overview and the review of updated team documentation. TEAM stands for Transmission Economic Assessment Methodology, but sometimes we also say TEAM methodology. I think it's okay. It was first introduced in 2004 and was approved in 2005 as the methodology for ISO Transmission Economic Planning. Since then, it has been more than 11 years. Many things changed in power industry, and it's particularly in California. So I think maybe some people may already forgot. In 2005, California power market is still a zonal market. And today, not only we operated the nodal market, we have seen energy imbalance market growing, and also we are talking about the regionalization. In the same time span, we have seen the renewable penetration increase dramatically in California. And also, the ISO planning department have conducted many transmission planning studies using TEAM, and we accumulated many experiences and also enhanced the methodology and the and its components a lot. And also the study tools and the study models advanced a lot. So because of all of those changes, I think it's a good time to give an overview of TEAM to reprise our memory, and also to help people to understand what team really said, and how the ISO implement the methodology in the practices. So that will become the two sections of this presentation. The first section is the overview of team, and the second one is the review of the updated team documentation. And as Neil mentioned earlier, the second section is review and updated of team documentation. It's the documentation update, not methodology review. Well, we still use team, and all our study implementations are remain in the team framework. So with that in mind, let's start to overview the team or team methodology. Team proposed principles for economic planning and the outline framework for to implement all the principles. Among all of those team components or principles, benefit assessment is a centerpiece. All other components or principles are pretty much supporting roles, but they are also important because we need them to make sure we have an accurate and robust benefit assessment. So in this overview section, we will touch each of them one by one. And before we start, I think it is worth noting that the original team documentation really focused on the energy benefit assessment based on the production cost simulation. Additional benefits or indirect benefits were discussed, but the original documentation didn't provide much details of the implementation because of the date and the modeling limitation at the time when the team was first introduced. So let's see the benefit assessment. In this principle, team provides a standard for measuring transmission benefit, transmission project benefit for customer, producer, and the transmission owners. So in the original documentation, team explored a range of perspectives, but in ISO's practice, we relied on the ratepayer perspective consistently. Other options are in the original team documentation are the society and the participant perspectives, but in the subsequent ISO practice, we pretty much discarded them. So looking at the key, the benefit assessment, basically in the team, it tried to answer provide answers to two questions. First answer is whose benefits we will look at, and on this slide we already know is we look at the ISO's ratepayer benefit, and the other question. This principle answer is how to measure the benefit. And it's relatively straightforward. We calculate the net present value of the benefit first using the social discount rate. Then we calculate the total cost, which is the present value of the annual revenue requirement. Then compare cost and benefit. If the benefit to cost ratio is greater than 1.0, then we can see some economic justification for this for the project and the study. So we will, in this overview section, didn't provide much detail, but in the review section, we will touch more detail on the benefit assessment. Go ahead, please.
This is Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. I want to go back to the previous slide. Do you have any insight on why the social discount rate was selected? And can you tell me what the current sort of number is being used for that
currently
discount rate?
We use 7%, but we may also look at some sensitivity numbers.
Is that 7% real or nominal?
I think it's real.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not an economic major, so when you talk real and nominal, I need to think.
Nominal includes the inflation rate.
Yeah, that's what I think. Thanks. Go ahead, Professor.
Pushkar Wagle from Plin RCI. I just wanted to add that it is indeed real interest rate that you have been using in the past, and you also used some alternate 5% and shown in a multiple direction. So using social discount rate can create sort of discrepancy between the revenue requirement that is funded by borrowing entities, cost of capital, and the benefits which are valued at a different discount rate. So there has been a debate in the past when the methodology was developed in 2005 timeframe whether you use a social discount rate or some other. So when you talk about getting rid of some of the obsolete stuff that was created during the 2005 timeframe, and the only guiding document that we have is the Palo Verde Diverse 2 report and a bunch of other reports that were developed probably for the past 26 and so on. The question here is, how would you make that determination about what is obsolete from this standpoint? It's sort of borderlines on methodology or certain things that you haven't been using for past several years. So it's more sort of a broader question. And social discount rate, or later on when you're going to talk about the marginal, the transmission loss part of it, I think some of it is pretty obsolete because you didn't have the kind of modeling tools at that point of time that you have today. So could you provide some insight into what would be part of this documentation update in terms of getting rid of the obsolete material?
I think we will talk about those in the second section. But as you said, one of the components we didn't use right now is to calculate something outside of the product cost simulation because in the early days, the software model didn't support that. So now we can use the production cost simulation to calculate many things in one shot. So those things basically is obsolete and we would not carry over. But in the next section we will touch more detail on that. Okay, that's as I said, we will have a more detail on the second section for the benefit assessment. So let's start to look at other team principles first. The network model and the market prices on this slide. In 2005, I think at that time, full network model it's still an issue because the computation limitation and the software, the production cost simulation tools were not that good. So people debate a lot, use Juno model or full network model in the simulation. But today, it's not an issue. We use full network model as a default in our studies. The full network model has a lot of advantages. We all recognize that. Not only we have a better or accurate network representation, but also we can calculate the losses in the production cost simulation. And also we can model transmission constraints and outages so that we can have a more realistic generation unit commitment and generation dispatch. So another principle have been the implementation have been changed as market price. In the original team documentation, there's a lot of discussion were given to the strategic bidding. But in the ISO practice, we realized that the market power mitigation in today's ISO market are much more effective than in 2005. So that allowed us to run product simulation in our economic planning study based on only use a cost-based product consummation. So we don't use strategic bidding anymore. So this is something obsolete. Dealing with uncertainty, it's always important in transmission planning, not only in economic planning. But it may be more important in economic planning, given the dimension of the data size. So we always need to do the sensitivity studies to test the robustness of the simulation results and the benefit calculation results. So in the current ISO practice, we developed sensitivity case by varying the most critical assumptions for the project under study. The table on this slide shows the typical sensitivities we normally look at. For example, the different load level, different hydro level, and different natural gas. Currently, we use predetermined to create those sensitivities, but the stochastic model can be used. Tom, go ahead, please.
So a question on the sensitivities. On the hydro sensitivities, is that a California high and low, or is it WECC-wide high and low? Also, do you consider changing CO2 prices, a range of CO2 prices?
For hydro, I think we if we do different hydro sensitivities, we would look at the whole WCC because we use a full network model. And the California system is not isolated. Then we look at the whole WCC. And the CO2, then we will, it's not on this list, but if it's needed, we would look at it.
So one other, on the previous slide, on the network model, are you using grid view? Do you look at the 10-year horizon, or are you using multiple years through the assessment? And what data set do you reference?
For the project study, when we evaluate the transmission economic project, we normally created two cases, 5-year and 10-year cases.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. When you test these different sensitivities, do you still have the a BCR of 1.0 that you're trying to satisfy? Is that how you're checking the robustness of the project that you're looking at?
I think our current process is we still rely on the base study to make decisions, but the purpose of running sensitivity is to make sure it's robust, getting worse in some tail condition.
Right. No, I understand how trying to test the, but if a sensitivity is likely and it shows that it's not economic, you'd still go ahead and look at the base case and use that as the basis to approve a project? Or how does that?
I think it's case by case. We need to, when we get there, we would do further analysis and see how big
the
impact.
I think documenting that in the update would be very helpful for everyone, because that's a, you know, usually sensitivities, how you do those, and, you know, you're trying to make a case of under all these conditions, this is still a winner, versus under some of these conditions, it's a winner, and we're not sure how those conditions might happen in the future. So I think that would be a good place to update. I thought the team had a lot of update on that, but I don't recall if it had it's a case by case, and we'll look at it and just look at the base case.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Who's first? So we'll go back.
Hi, this is Yobo Wong from California. So I have
regarding the base.
And then we're experiencing this before. Yeah. Push and reduce. Okay. Regarding whether the base case drives the final conclusion or we collect a number of different sensitivity cases drive the more comprehensive benefit cost ratio, this is a very complex issue. And if you're documented, I think it's also very difficult in my personal view. I'm not doing transmission. I'm not working in the transmission department anymore. I'm just kind of being a long-time observer looking at the California ISO, also other ISOs. In the Midwest, they use collections of not only the base case and also sensitivity cases. They assign weights to all those sensitivity cases, and collectively they calculate a composite BCR. And this is not something which is new, actually. In the beginning of the team methodologies in Palo Verde DevRisk 2 project, the California ISO, we also did the same thing. We assigned the probabilities of those sensitivity cases and calculated the collective or composite BCR. But in practice, in any case, it is very controversial for those weights of sensitivity probabilities. Yeah. It is the same as the base case. So for practical purposes, I still agree with the East comment. I mean, it should be judged case by cases. If, for instance, that the base case drives a good BCR, but the sensitivity cases cause a big concern, which BCR is too low, and then it should trigger a very specific discussion whether the BCR is robust enough. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I would like to add a comment here. Thanks, Silva. There was a joke among engineers. We said maybe it's not that hard to do the stochastic planning study for engineers, but it's much harder for management to make stochastic decision. So anyway, that's a comment. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm David Oliver with Navient. What do you mean by for your hydro high and low if data available? Which data sources are you talking about, or what availability is at issue here?
That's a tough one. This is why this is why I say that if data available, it's very hard to collect different hydro data. In the last two Type C common case cycles, WCC didn't provide high hydro and low hydro data. The most recent available high hydro and low hydro data is for, if I remember correctly, is for 2022 Type C common case. If we need to do the different hydro sensitivity studies, we would probably need to work with WCC and other entities with hydro units to gather data. Keith
White, PUC staff. So on the one hand, you described that this is going to be sort of a straightforward update of the documentation. On the other hand, it's already been, you've already stated and others have, that the world has changed a lot. We're studying a lot of new options and scenarios, and the model is obviously of interest in being, the team methodology is of interest in being applied to multiple areas such as for interregional projects, for example. So we've seen a lot of production simulation applications in recent years that are pretty innovative, and they cover a wide range. I mean, we have the EIN studies, and we have the SB350 studies, and we have a lot of flexibility studies, and it goes on and on. So we've learned a lot, and a lot of that is potentially relevant, and probably a lot of it would be relevant to particular team applications. So my question is, there's no way you can lay out how you're going to use all that, apply all that you've learned recent years when you apply team going forward. So my question is, when you update the documentation, are you going to address, to what extent are you going to try to address these different issues and point out the possibilities for applying team going forward? Because there are going to be a lot of people that are going to want to know about how these issues are going to be addressed, and you can't really answer them, but you can't really ignore them either.
It's Neil here with the ISO. Given this is more of an overarching question, I'll jump in. The bottom line right now is that we see it's necessary to update the documentation for how we apply the team methodology within the transmission planning process, capturing how it's evolved over the number of years. The original methodology, as he indicated, had laid out a number of options that as people worked through those, a number of those were laid out more hypothetically. As people work through real-life examples, there tended to be a coalescing around certain approaches. We wanted to get that documentation in place. At this time, we're not looking at expanding within this initiative that documentation to talk about how the team may or may not be used for other purposes in the interregional discussions or the regionalism discussions. You know, there's a discussion of the team methodology playing a role in certain cost allocation responsibility issues, but that's beyond what we're looking at here. We want to get the foundation in place that's clearer than we think it is today about what the current methodology is applied within the transmission planning cycle and within the process. Now, some of the other learnings you talked about, I think some of those are also part of either which scenarios or sensitivities you pick, but the framework and the updated documentation is a good effort regardless. There will continue, of course, to have to be judgment calls made on how you apply that methodology in certain cases.
One suggestion is that when you produce the updated documentation, you maybe define the universe to which it applies and then point out there's all these other things that you know are important, but they're outside of your universe, then people know what confined universe you're talking about.
It's Neil here. I agree we need to be clear about what it does apply to. I'll push back on identifying all the circumstances it doesn't apply to, because that's a very long list.
Thanks, Keith. So let's move on. We still have many slides remaining. The last team principle is the resource alternative. Probably, to me, resource alternative is probably the largest uncertainty in the economic studies, economic planning studies. So I think maybe this is why team listed as a standalone principle. In ISO's planning study, we always look at different look at the different resource alternatives. In recent years, we cooperate with state agencies to develop the portfolios DT and DR scenarios. We use those as input to our study, also including energy storage and OTC retirement and replacement. So with that, it's, I think we overviewed all five principles of team. So maybe it's good to use a summary slide to highlight some key points before we move on to the review section. The team provided principles and a framework for economic planning studies, and that's no change. But the implementation of team principles have changed. We have discussed that right now we only use ISO read pair perspective for benefit assessment. We relied on full network models for production simulation and use a cost-based production cost simulation. We developed the sensitivity cases for to deal with uncertainty and use state agencies input for resource alternatives. But before we move to the next section, I would like to look at see if any additional question on the review. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, Renee Steichen from SmartWires. I was just wondering, in addition to resource alternatives that you're looking at, are you looking also at transmission, more non-traditional transmission alternatives, such as phase shifting transformers, power flow control, for example?
I think, yeah, we that's a part of transmission alternatives. It's not a resource alternative. When we study transmission projects, we would look at the different alternative transmission alternatives. You will see some examples in afternoon's presentation for economic preliminary economic study results. Yeah, go ahead.
Paul Nelson, Southern California. You may have mentioned this before. How long is the projection when you're doing the cost and benefits? Is it 10 years, 20, 30?
We look at the economic life of the transmission project. If it is a new project, it's 50 years. If it's reconductoring, rewiring, we assume it's 40 years.
Do you have a 40-year projection forward of production costs?
No. We only run the production simulation for 5 years and 10 years.
Oh, okay.
We extrapolate to 50 years or 40 years, depending on what type of upgrade it is.
And then you sort of just escalate those production costs out if you're doing something with a 40-year life? Or will you cover that later when you get to more details?
We will talk about that a little bit more.
Okay, I'll hold off.
If we don't, you can
I'll hold off.
We will discuss about that.
Okay.
Tom?
I'm curious if, and obviously the focus is on the economics, the production cost savings. Are there other costs that are derived out of the modeling, such as, you know, operating constraints, you know, say reserve violations or, say, curtailment of renewables? Is there a cost for curtailment of renewables that is used? Those types of costs, are they included in the economic analysis?
Yeah, right there on this slide, the last bullet, market and the grid modeling that impact the benefit calculation. We will cover that. Thanks.
Okay, let's turn to the phone lines. And just a friendly reminder for those in the room also, if you do have a question or comment, please remember to state your name and the company you represent for the benefit of those on the phone. If you do have a question also on the phone, please queue up by selecting #2. And Aaron, I do see a hand raised, so let's go to our first caller.
Yeah, good morning. My name is Joseph Abuleman. I'm calling from the Office of Ratepayer Advocates at California PUC in San Francisco. You talked about looking at TIM from the ratepayer perspectives. My question is, what rate payers are you talking about? Are you talking about the PTOs, or are you talking about the LECs and users?
We are talking about ISO rate payers.
Now, who are those? I know that the PTOs are
ISOs.
And users. So
and users.
Excuse me?
It's Neil here. I'll take that on because I admit the use of the term ISO ratepayers is a bit and perhaps deliberately ambiguous. We're referring to end-use consumers that are paying utility rates, regulated rates, inside the ISO footprint, recognizing that we expect, and these are always fundamental assumptions, that we expect that the costs ultimately find their way through to the end-use customer. And these decisions are talking about making investments, producing benefits to the long-term benefit of end-use customers who are also paying for those facilities through their rates. We try to avoid getting into, we are not going to try to take on proving that an incremental cost will directly flow through to an individual customer in 1 year, how that plays out. So we're deliberately taking a broader view that ultimately increased regulated costs will find their way through to regulated consumers. So that's what we're referring to, is just ultimately people who are paying rates for electricity, regulated rates, inside the footprint.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to the review section. The first bullet on this slide, I exactly copy-paste from the previous one on the first slide of this presentation. It's not because I'm lazy. That's because it's really important. We need to keep that in mind through the whole presentation. It's a documentation update, not methodology review. What we are going to do is to remove the obsolete contents and clarify and update the components to reflect ISO's practices. And in this review section, I will cover some details of the implementation for benefit assessment and the cost calculation, and also some modeling issues that may impact the benefit calculation. Since all of those updates and reviews are based on ISO's practices, I think maybe it's good to list some key points in ISO's practice of using T. First, in ISO's economic planning practice, we assessing economic benefit for rate-based projects. We look at the benefit from ISO's rate payer perspective, but now not only the energy benefit, but also some indirect benefit, including capacity benefit, transmission loss saving, and any other benefit which would apply. We did a lot of market and grid modeling enhancement during our studies, and we will cover those in the remaining of the presentation. Still, we start from the benefit evaluations, since it's a central piece of the team. We look at the energy benefit first. Energy benefit is assessed based on production cost estimation, and it's the difference between the net load payment, difference of net load payment between the cases with and without the project and the study. In general, net load payment is equal to the gross load payment minus the generated profit minus transmission revenue. Since we use a full network model, the gross load payment is relatively easy. Actually, all the characteristics is not that hard. load payment is basically the load times the LMP as a load bus. And the generator profit is the revenue, generator revenue minus the generation cost. And the transmission revenue is the congestion cost plus the wheeling cost, particularly its wheeling out cost. So because we look at the benefit from the ratepayer perspective, we need to define ownership in a production cost model. The ownership is used to indicate which transmission revenue and which generator profit will be counted to offset a ratepayer payment. In particularly in ISO's production cost model, we define ownership as ISO owned. But in this economic planning context, this ownership is different from the ownership, physical ownership in real life. So I think we need to give a further look on the ownership definition. The owned generator, owned facility, it's a facility operated to ISO ratepayer advantage. For transmission, it's straightforward. It's ISO's PTO's owned transmission. For generators, we look at different type of generators. If a generator is physically owned by the utilities that serve ISO's load, then we model them as ISO-owned generators in the PCM, production cost simulation model. For wind and solar generators, if they are under contract with ISO's LSE to meet the state renewable energy goal, then we model them ISO-owned. For other generators, if they are under contract, we will review them. Particularly, we look at the type of contract and the length of the contract life. And more importantly, for those generators under contract, their contract information need to be available for public. If they say, okay, sorry, the contract is confidential, then we will not use it.
I have a question here. Why this is Jan Strath from San Diego Gas and Electric. I guess I don't understand why the fact that the contract is public or not makes a difference as to whether or not you count producer surplus towards or as a ratepayer benefit. That seems to be like sort of an arbitrary distinction, because especially like in local capacity requirement areas, it's a pretty safe assumption that all that generation for the next 50 years is going to be under a contract with utility. It may not be public, but that doesn't change the fact that the benefits from the producer surplus are going to flow back to consumers for that full period. At least that's the way I'm thinking about it.
I think we're going to pause our production simulation model to the public domain, and everybody can see it. If it's total information is confidential, we cannot use them in our model. So this is, I think, the main reason for that.
Again, I don't see why that really is relevant. If you've got an idea what the generator's production costs are, because you know what its heat rate curve is, you have an estimate of the gas prices, you're going to have an approximation of what its revenues are and an approximation of what its actual costs are. So you know what the producer surplus is regardless of what the contract says. So I guess I'm still unclear why you would exclude that from being a credit towards the consumers.
It's Neil here. Actually, Jan, I think we'd appreciate your comments on this, just from our position, we're also part of the public when it comes to some of this detail, that there's information we don't have access to ourselves. So it's very, very difficult for us to defend a decision based on information we might not have available as well as not being able to share it with anyone else, which does get in the way of that transparent planning process. So, you know, like I said, we'd appreciate your thoughts on this, but I do think you need to consider the perspective of us defending something on the basis of information that we may not, we don't have either. So us making assumptions about whether and how the benefits for something we don't have visibility of may or may not be accruing to ratepayers is, it's a tough thing for us to say, well, clearly there's a ratepayer benefit there. So,
but you're taking the default position, which is it does not flow to the ratepayers, which I don't think that's equally, you know, unjustified.
Yeah. True, but it's more conservative from defending to the ratepayers that we're making a long-term investment. We, the industry, are making a long-term investment on their behalf. So it admittedly is a conservative approach. I agree.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul. This is Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. To follow up on Jan, is the issue with this, but he brought up the issue of confidentiality of the data or having the data, because it seems like you would have the data because you have the stuff, you have information for default energy bids. But I'm assuming that data is confidential, so I'm trying to understand better, is it a lack of information or is it a confidentiality issue?
Let me clarify this, the second part. In production consolidation, all the heat rate, the economic parameters for generators, actually, we use generic data. It's not the confidential data. We use generic data.
I thought generator data would be confidential.
We use generic. It's the industry generic.
Oh, generic. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, Aaron, can we go to our phone lines? I do see a hand raised.
Hi, this is Dario Shumani with California Wind Energy Association. I noticed that you, in calculating the energy benefit to the ratepayers, you focus on California ISO ratepayers, whatever that means, by the way. But in performing your production simulation studies, you do not optimize grid operation on an ongoing basis based on the cost to the California ratepayers. You do it based on WECC-wide cost minimization. Is that correct? Or you even there you focus on California ISO ratepayers?
Our model is a full WCC network. We do the whole WCC optimization.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, Pushkar.
Pushkar Wagner from PNRCI. I hate to go back a couple of slides, but on page 22, you have listed transmission loss savings and the other benefits applicable as distinct benefit categories, and that sort of, if you're going to do a transmission loss savings separately, that assumes that the model doesn't have the capability to do the transmission loss calculations altogether, which is, I don't think, is true. You do have the capability where you have the marginal loss component of LNP.
Yeah.
That
we
will be coming to that.
Yeah,
so basically, it shouldn't be the separate, because I have never seen in past several studies you separate out marginal loss savings.
We will talk about that.
Okay, yeah. So it shouldn't be that. And in terms of the other benefit, you're talking about quantifiable benefits or just qualitative. When you do the documentation, you may better want, because we have seen in the past, you quantify typically the production cost savings and the capacity savings. Those are the two numbers. There might be some additional other benefits that are ancillary and more qualitative or some reliability sort of nature. But it's better to sort of separate out what exactly are the quantifiable benefits and how exactly the benefit cost ratio is purely based on those quantifiable benefits rather than this other stuff. You know, it can get a little bit confusing when you have listed few other distinct categories there.
So yeah, you will see more details in the following slides.
Okay. Thank you.
Tom?
Tom Miller, Pacific Gas and Electric.
On the generator revenues, could you give us some insights as to what revenue streams are included in that? And also on generator costs, what are the cost components that are part of that?
Revenue include, generator revenue include energy from the generation output, energy revenue, and also the ancillary service revenue. And costs include fuel cost, maintenance, operating, or what they call variable cost, kind of thing. And for, I think, since we modeled pump storage and energy batteries as a generator, so we also, for those, we also consider the pumping or charging cost.
Okay. So just one more follow-up. How are, I'm assuming that imports are handled as other generators are not included in the, calculation? Are they, how are imports handled?
Sorry, I didn't quite follow your question.
As a supply to the ISO territory, you know, how are imports included in the, say, the cost-benefit calculation?
The import.
Imports, yes.
There's two parts. If it's, some when we look at the transmission revenue, it's if there's the cost the congestion on the import interfaces, there's definitely there would be some transmission revenues for the rate payer. And also, but the wheeling is not that part because we only consider the wheeling out cost. And also some out of state generators, they may be owned or partially owned by the ISO utilities. So then we will model them as owned generators. So the profit of the, those generators would be counted.
Okay. Ms. Jan, I have a follow-up question on that one.
Okay.
For an intertie line like the California Oregon Transmission Project, mm-hmm. When there's congestion, so you have a price differential between within California and then in the balancing authority outside of California,
yeah.
How do you actually compute the congestion revenues then? It's easy when it's completely inside the ISO balancing authority area, but I'm wondering about when you have interties between balancing authority areas.
I remember we used the full network model. So all congested land or interface would show a shadow price in the results. And basically, the congestion cost is a shadow price times the rating or the flow. Basically, the same when there's a congestion. So it's not.
But so you know, half the line is owned by other parties.
I
still credit 100% of the congestion rents to California?
So then it's been come to this ownership definition. PTO own the transmission. Say, for example, PG&E own or ISO own 50% of that land, then we only count the 50% of the congestion cost. Okay, so we have a talk about the energy benefit, and now we start to look at the indirect benefit. So we have mentioned in original team documentation, the indirect benefit had been discussed, but didn't have much detail of implementation. But in ISO's practice, we look at a number of indirect benefits. For example, if a transmission project can potentially reduce the local capacity requirement, then there may be a local capacity benefit. Normally, that type of benefit need to be assessed in a study similar to ISO's LCR study. And if a project can increase the import capability to the ISO, and potentially there would be a system capacity benefit. But it needs another two conditions need to be met. First, the importing region here is ISO needed to show the capacity deficit in the resource adequacy assessment, and also the marginal capacity cost in the exporting region, for example, Arizona, Nevada, whatever, need to be lower than the marginal capacity cost in California. And normally, we assessed the system capacity benefit through the power flow and the stability studies. Another type of capacity benefit is a delivery benefit. It's actually it's similar to system capacity benefit, but it's just one is for focused on the import, the delivery benefit is focused on the generator. If a project can increase the generator deliverability to ISO, then potentially there's a delivery benefit. And again, we needed to show there's a, we needed to know if there's a capacity deficit in ISO. Since in the past there's not many projects show the delivery benefit, so this is why we say for delivery benefit it's a case we would assess that on the case by case basis. Kevin.
Kevin Woodruff, consultant for TURN. On that second block of bullets on the last page, you talk about some of your inputs to benefit are increase in capability and deficit importing region, the marginal capacity costs. And you say you assess these through power flow and stability studies. I don't see how you get power flow. How do you do like capacity deficits using power flow and stability studies when you're, I mean, this is like a system planning kind of exercise, and the marginal capacity cost is also something that you don't get out of a power flow study. So okay. I was looking for the sources that you use for.
Okay, probably you'll miss part of what I said. It's, the capacity deficit need to be shown in resource adequacy assessment. That's a separate study. It's not in a planning study.
Okay. A resource adequacy assessment. That who does that? Is it, you do that internally here, or does that come from a TEPSI database or from a PUC? Or?
I think PUC and ISO have some joint study to assess the resource adequacy for California and the California ISO.
Okay. I'm not familiar with such studies, but anyway. And then marginal capacity costs. Where do the marginal capacity costs come from?
I think that's I don't know. Yeah, maybe we laugh on a different thing. Robert would take care of it.
I think the best way to, this is Robert Sparks, California ISO. I think the best way to answer that question is just from past examples for both the Delaney Colorado River economic project analysis and the Ariel and El Dorado economic project analysis. Both of those are on the ISO website. Those provide some examples of how that's been done in the past.
Thank you.
So actually, I'll start where Robert left off with the last two projects. They were pushed over the top on the benefit costs because of significant capacity value. And just looking up at the slide that's on the screen now, we can see there are some complexities and in your last discussion of computing the capacity value, and I assume that you're not planning to run power flow studies as part of the team, but maybe that's part of my question. But I think I would hope that when you're updating the documentation, you would spend some time updating and elaborating on, I'm kind of echoing here, you would update and elaborate on the capacity benefit methodology, because it's been a little bit, you know, there's been a lot of debate and discussion about it in those last two projects in particular, and I think that'd be a place that people would be interested in seeing you know, expanded and explained it a little bit more.
Yeah, thanks for your comments, Keith. Tom.
Tom Miller, PG&E. On the local area capacity benefit, if there's a deferral of a project, how is the benefit? What's the proxy for calculating the value for a deferred LCR need? Is my question.
I think the short answer is if. For the existing system, we do the LCR study and we identify the LCR requirement. And if we put in a new transmission project into the model, basically we can import more power into the local pocket, and we may reduce the requirement, LCR requirement for that area. Then we probably we don't need to procure that many gigawatt of local generators, and then reduce the cost.
So if it was, say, you deferred it for 5 years, you know, how would you?
Oh, okay, I see what you mean. It's, but we not only do the year-high LCR study, we also run a long-term LCR study. Probably we would use a long-term LCR study case to look at the benefit, LCR benefit.
And one other, this is on the, you brought up two benefits, LCR, and also increase in imports. I'm curious how hypothetically you might handle increase in export, you know, if that export, you know, you'd have an outer region, maybe a higher price, and maybe you're, I'll say, avoiding curtailment of renewables. How would that be estimated?
I think the local capacity benefit is different from system capacity benefit. For system capacity, definitely we need to compare the marginal cost. But for local capacity, it's purely reliability driven. If based on our LCR methodology, if we because of the reliability limitation, if we need that X amount of LCR, then we have to procure.
Sorry to clarify, not LCR. I'm sorry. I was assuming that the import, increasing that would be a value to the system, and you're looking at the differential between, you know, the export region to the ISO, and there's a savings that would be calculated. I get that. If it's the opposite situation where it increases, you know, export capability, and there's benefit from the ISO footprint to export, say, to avoid curtailment, will that, is that included as well? That's my question.
Yeah, wouldn't that be automatically picked up in the production cost analysis?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's, for the energy part, actually, it's already embedded in the production cost calculation. So this export, I mean, for example, it's, if you export the energy, and there would be a wheel-out cost on the interface. And then we'll collect some billing revenue, so that would be part of the benefit. Thanks, Tom, and thanks, Jane. So let's move on to the transmission losses, since several questions have been asked for this transmission loss saving benefit. Actually, when we say this, when we categorize this transmission loss saving as an indirect benefit, actually it's not 100% true. It's a hybrid between energy benefit and the indirect benefit. There's three components for the energy saving. If new transmission line can save, reduce the losses, then there would be some energy saving. And that's already calculated in the production cost analysis and will be a part of the energy benefit. But for peak saving, it's outside the production cost analysis. We need to use our regular power flow studies to identify the peak saving. And that peak saving actually can be translated to capacity benefit. We still need to go through those criteria, see if there's a capacity deficit. Similarly, the generator deliverability benefit, if we reduce for, normally it has to be in a generator, close to a generator area, it's similar to a generator interconnect study. If we reduce the losses, and the deliverability would increase. And it also can be translated to capacity benefit, and we need to look at if the ISO has a capacity deficit. If there's not, there's no deliverability benefit.
Would I be right in understanding that a deliverability increase could also be a NIC increase, an increase in maximum import capability?
I think that we would categorize that a system capacity benefit. There are still some other indirect benefits we have considered or implemented in our previous studies, but they're all on a case-by-case basis. Public policy benefit. A project may impact the renewable portfolio calculation in assessing remote or out-of-state resources. And also, it may bring some benefit from avoiding overbuild. And renewable integration, we can see some reduce the curtailment or reduce ancillary service requirement. But all of those benefits, only can be materialized when they are transmission congestion related. And the market design has to need to allow the energy sharing or ancillary service sharing among regions or areas. Also, another indirect benefit is if a reliability or policy project can be avoided because of the economic project under study, then we need to give this economic project a credit. It will be a part of the benefit of this project. I would call it avoided cost benefit. The cost calculation is another piece for it's another piece for the benefit assessment. Because we always need to compare the benefit and the cost to get idea for the economic justification. But depending on the study stage, we may use a different approach to estimate the cost. For example, in the general screening stage, we use a per unit cost on the ISO website times 1.45 to get the revenue requirement. That's for screening purpose. But if a project needs to go through the solicitation process, then we can use the project sponsor, the submittal. they need to submit to ISO their revenue requirement, capital cost, and the revenue requirement. We would use that. And if it's a purely ISO proposed project and there's no other source, well, probably then we would use the ISO's type model to calculate the revenue requirement. The link on this slide is you can, from that you can find the ISO type model.
Okay. Ms. Jan, I got a question on the second bullet. I guess I don't understand how that works, because the first thing you have to establish is a need for some upgrade. So you wouldn't know at the time you're doing the team analysis what the actual cost of the project is by the project sponsor, because we don't know who the project sponsor is.
Yeah, but I think I said depending on what the state of this process. We may need to provide additional evidence.
I see. So you're saying after the project's been approved, then let's test it and see if it really makes sense. Okay.
It's Neil here. There have been the odd permitting processes that we have to go through after, so when we're putting together the testimony, I think that's what he was getting at. Thanks.
So there's a, now we can move on to the market and grid modeling, and there's a more, probably more technical components there. Hopefully people can find it more interesting and more fun. So energy imbalance market, we know it's growing. It will impact the generation dispatch and the flow patterns on the interfaces. But the problem is the energy imbalance market is not a day-ahead market. The production cost simulation we used in the economic planning study basically is hourly simulation to mimic the day-ahead market. So the EIM is not automatically fitting into the economic planning and production cost simulation. Still, we considered the impact of EIM in our previous planning cycle by taking a discount on the hurdle rates among EIM entities, and the discount we use was the ratio between the energy transaction through EIM and in the whole market. Last year, the ratio we used is 5% based on the Pacific Corp EIM study report. And I think if we still follow that same approach, along with the EIM growing, that number need to be changed. But we do not recommend to consider the full effect of EIM in project justification. The reason is for entities, it's relatively easy to exit EIM, but the transmission project normally has a long economic life. Talking about the hurdle rate, that's another interesting topic. We use hurdle rates in production cost model to mimic the actual transaction hurdle between balancing authority areas or regions in real life. Normally, hurdle rates include transmission access charge and grid management charge and other frictions. Hurdle rate can be modeled as an exporting hurdle. That's the most case we do that, or interface hurdle for some very specific situations. In production model, hurdle rates are normally implemented by adding extra cost to the generators, which contribute to the flow of the line or interfaces with hurdles. The hurdle rate can be enforced in the unit commitment stage or in the dispatch stage or both. So for different type of hurdle, we may treat them differently. Who's first? Kevin.
This Jan, I'm on the hurdle rates, grid management charge. And I know this is not a big deal because, frankly, I think this whole hurdle rate approach is as much art as it is science. But it is curious to me that you would include a grid management charge explicitly in a hurdle rate because it doesn't, there is no, the grid management charge doesn't vary with the amount of exports between regions, does it?
I think it's for ISO, if a generator only serves the ISO below, definitely it doesn't need to pay GMC. But if it's somehow it scheduled the generation of energy to other states outside the ISO, I think that that part of generation needs to pay the GMC.
So you're saying exports pay the grid management charge?
Yeah, this is what we learned right now. That's what I think.
Kevin Woodruff. Jan actually didn't ask the question I'm going to ask. In the last two bullets there, the wording of the major bullet, their hurdle rates are normally implemented by adding an extra cost to generators contributing to the flow. Do you add hurdle rates broadly across regions?
I think somehow we missed some words on the slide, but I didn't say that. It's to the flow of lines or interfaces with hurdles. It's not
it's not to the generators themselves. It's across the flow gates or something, or
would need some explanation from actual software coding perspective. You need to calculate the capacity. I think it's distribution factor of generator to the line or to the interface, and see what is the flow impact is, and then add some extra cost.
Do you run the model and go back in and assign cost based on?
No, it's already in the model.
Okay, and you do a generator by generator or across broad.
All generators.
All generators. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. That's right. Slide. There's some other modeling issues and also enhancement we have made over the years. And so this service. Right now we do the co-optimization for ancillary service with energy. Ancillary service we currently model in the ISO production cost model include regulation up and down, and load following up and down, and the spinning and non-spinning. And starting from this year, we model the frequency response requirement as a SPIs, and it will be co-optimized with all other ancillary services and energy. And we also did a lot of work to enhance the transmission model, and particularly on the transmission constraints, in addition to the facility rating. We model contingencies and SPIs based on LCR and reliability assessment. In production cost model, we don't model all contingencies from P1 to P7. And we just model those critical contingencies and credible to local or system. And we also model nomograms. For example, the coil nomograms, and plus 15, plus 26, or any other nomograms we identified in planning study or operation study. And we also model schedule outages and D rates. But I think it needed to be clear that we only consider those outages that may produce routine congestions. If it's only once in 10 years or in 20 years, probably we will not need to consider those. So this is the summary slides for the review section. I think this is the first time we say that the framework of team remains the same. There's no change. But the implementation has been updated to reflect the changes in the market and the grid operation and the planning processes. ISO read pairs perspective, if the perspective has been relied upon for benefit calculation, because a read pair will ultimately fund the development through the reads. We added indirect benefit assessment into the team framework, and we also enhanced the product model to reflect market and the grid operation. In the next, we will welcome stakeholder comments on the update and the review sections, and also probably we would draft updated team documentation. Okay.
Kevin Woodruff, on this slide, are the comments due with us November 30th also, along with all the other comments? Yes, okay. And then the team documentation will be out.
We don't have timeline right now.
Okay.
We want to see stakeholder comments first.
Fair enough. Okay. And I had one last question on the congestion costs. You know, there's an assumption that they all flow through to ratepayers. You're probably aware there's a kerfuffle in PJM now where ratepayers are only getting half of them. Okay. There's some sort of change to the calculation methodology. I don't claim to understand it. In our comments, I can provide you the citations to it. But I'd highlight that I understand where that came from. I followed the original development of the team. But I think the ISO may need to look at its own, you know, collection of congestion revenues, where they actually go, to confirm or not whether that 100% assumption is still accurate. So just one comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Keith. So there'll be comments on this presentation due in 2 weeks. Then you'll produce updated documentation. So my thought is, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been discussed, and it sounds like a lot of the way the world is different, the world that team would have to deal with now is different than it was, 11 years ago. And some of that's going to be reflected in your update. So where I'm going with this, I think it might also be useful if people had a chance to read the actual updated documentation. It would probably give them a much fuller idea of you know, how you're describing for basically the community, you know, the stakeholders, everybody, the updated team process. And would people be able to then comment or provide additional input on the updated written documentation at some point in the future? And it might be much more useful and complete than what people would provide based on the presentation today.
Yeah, but I think it will be a process. Either way, you can provide a comment, and then we work on the draft based on your comments and this presentation. And then we pause the first draft, and we still stakeholders still have the opportunity to provide a further comment, and then we would revise the draft. So it would be a process. I think either way, we can discuss internally first and see how it goes.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to quickly go to our phone lines before we move on to our next presentation. If you do have a question or comment, you can enter the queue by selecting #2. And Melissa, I do see a hand raised. If we can go to that caller, please. Caller, you may have your line on mute. Go ahead. Hello, this is Connie Dorland with the Office of Ratepayer Advocates. Apologies. I wanted to ask page 27. I wanted to go back to that and ask about the other benefits. You list that there are other indirect benefits that would be considered. Do you mean just public policy, renewable integration, and avoided cost of other projects? Or would you consider indirect benefits of economic activity as a result of new facilities?
It's Neil Miller here for the ISO. We expect the other benefits. We did not want to limit the range of electric system benefits, but we do not see moving into other societal benefits of employment benefits or economic stimulus benefits. We think that's beyond the pale of what we can get into in a reasonable transmission project economic evaluation.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. And you know, my question kind of comes around with the second part that, Neil, that you talked about, the purpose of this, so that folks can be familiar with it better outside the region and what the TAC options might be. This page 27 indicates that the benefits of building a transmission line to access remote renewables or a policy need could be captured in the TEAM. Am I understanding that right, that is possible?
So we do not see the economic study and the TEAM methodology supplanting the policy process that we have with the state commissions. We do see that there are some collateral benefits of once you're planning a transmission system, you're pursuing a certain basket of portfolios, that there may be some collateral benefits for upgrades to transmission facilities that could be addressed through TEAM. But this was a dangerous bullet for us to raise, because there is a line that we have to draw between saying, oh, we're going to take an economic perspective and redo the CPUC's policy-driven portfolios and the state decisions on in versus out of state. We're clearly not going there, but there can be some potential upgrades that, given the policy-driven portfolios we're driving to, there may be some additional benefits that are warranted coming out of the coming out of what else is being pursued. So there's a line there that we're not crossing, and I think that's the line you're suggesting.
That is the line
we might have crossed.
Well, I'm advocating that you do fully cross that in my other comments for the TAC options. But I think it's pretty critical that you draw that bright line when you update this document, so that the other states who are considering how their public policy will be managed by the ISO in a regional expansion will precisely understand where that line is, because I've had a hard time for the last several years understanding that, but I think that would be helpful for everyone. I
appreciate the feedback. Thanks.
And this is Jan from San Diego, and I guess I would just echo Dave's comment. And, you know, we've pointed out for a long time now that the RPS calculator model, which actually produces those portfolios in-state, out-of-state, is not, you know, it doesn't use the TEAM methodology. You actually have a superior methodology here, and it always is a little surprising to me that we wouldn't want to find a better mousetrap if one existed. So while I respect the ISO's decision not to, you know, try to improve upon what the PUC is providing, on the other hand, I think we need to take a little more open-minded approach to some of these questions.
Pushkar Wagle from FLINA RCI. Are there any plans after you update documents to run it by Market Surveillance Committee and seek their input? The reason why I'm talking about this is that there are certain elements that would be purely refined, and they had the original input, or they have been members of the Market Surveillance Committee who have been following this process for a while. So they may have certain good ideas about, providing some input on some elements of the team methodology.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Go ahead. I'm David Oliver with Navigant. So is the model as it currently stands able to do sub-regional allocations, or would that require some additional changes?
I think we have to ask what you mean by a sub-regional.
Well, allocation. For the TAC options, you would assign certain costs to certain sub-regions. That's the proposal for economic benefits to see who has to pay for the project. I'm just curious if the model as it stands now has the capability to figure out which costs and benefits are applied to each region, sub-region. I'm not asking to do it. I'm just asking if it's, as it currently stands, can it do it?
We're not currently doing it. I don't recall investigating whether we could. I'm not sure we would wade into that territory.
Okay. The other question is this now going to be more of a living document now instead of every 10 years getting an update? We'll kind of make sure that it's kept up to date on a more regular basis. Will it be part of the study plan process, in a sense, for each transmission planning period?
Our expectation is that the methodology update here will be set and expect to last for some time. Some of the parameters that are used, we expect, can be discussed in the study programs themselves. But we're not up for revisiting the entire methodology every year as part of our study plan.
Yeah, that's what I meant, necessarily the no inputs that going into it, not necessarily the methodology, although that may at some point be worth investigating as well.
Yeah, I just want to follow quickly on Navigant's comment, because I think the model is capable of actually breaking down the benefits by subregion, because you know where the generators, who owns the generators, or you know who they're contracted to, you know where the loads are located. So at least to a large extent, I think it is able to do that subregional differentiation. I think that the challenge gets in trying to figure out for the alternative case against which you're establishing the benefits, who would have built and paid for certain assets in the alternative. That's always a big challenge, but I think the model itself has got the basic capability.
I think I agree. Thanks.
Okay.
All right, thank you, everyone.